80% the same and 20% different from each other. John is 80% different from Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and 20% the same. So you have sort of a supplemental gospel in John. And John focuses primarily only on the last 2 months of Jesus' life, and for the most part, only in the last week of Jesus' life. But we have information in John about Jesus leading up to the crucifixion that we would not know if John, if the Spirit had not given John this information to give to us. And so, one thing that I observed, and I read through this, I guess, as you may have, many years, without dawning on me, that you get to the last week of Jesus' life very soon in the book of John. In fact, in John chapter 13, we are at the Last Supper already, even though we have, you know, 8 more chapters to go. So you're at the last night that Jesus has with His disciples, beginning here in John chapter 13. And you don't transition from that night until you get to John chapter 18, where He goes into the Garden of Gethsemane. So you have these 5 chapters that give all this information of events and words that occurred on one night in Jesus' life. Now, Jesus was not taken by surprise when they arrested Him. He was born to die. He knew when He read His Old Testament that those prophecies were talking about Him. He knew that one day He was going to be arrested, He was going to be tried, He was going to be condemned, He was going to be executed, and then He was going to rise from the dead on the third day. So He sees that coming. He knows His time is at hand. And here in John chapter 13, He has His last quiet moment with His apostles before all those events begin. Now, if you knew that your time was at an end, and some, we don't always know that, but sometimes we have a similar situation. Maybe the family's called in, and if we're blessed to have our mind at that time and be able to think and reason and talk, communicate with them, what is it that you might want to say? What would be on your mind at the end of your life? I suppose that just generally speaking, many people might be concerned about their financial assets, you know, how they're going to disperse them. They might be concerned about their business, you know, is it going to continue after me? And here's what I would like for you to do as far as hiring and firing and decisions that will be coming up. Others might talk about the property, you know, the farm or whatever it is, the livestock. But none of those things were on Jesus' mind. He never owned much property. He didn't start any business. But He had something on His mind that night. That's a 4-letter word that Jesus is almost synonymous for, L-O-V-E. Jesus talked about many things, but back of all of them was the love that He had for humankind. That's why He was here. That's what we're going to be talking about in our sermons today. And so I thought we would spend this class looking at this one night in Jesus' life, the last night that He had with His disciples before His arrest, and see how love was prompting Him to give His life, to give His instruction to them, and how they were to respond to His love. And that's what I hope that we will see as we go through this. The two ideas that we'll emphasize in this morning's sermon, it will be feeling the love that Jesus has for us, and we all need to be reassured of that. And then tonight's lesson, our response to His love. So let's just read through this text and I'll make comments as we go through. If I have counted right, there are 31 references to love in these 5 chapters. Let's read and see. We won't read all of them, I suppose, but let's see how many you can do that reading on your own if we don't find all 31 of them. But let's start in verse 1. Now before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that His hour was come, that He should depart out of this world unto the Father, here's the first reference. Having loved His own, which were in the world, He loved them unto the end. Not only did Jesus love them in the sunshine, when everything was exciting at the beginning of His ministry, when He was calling them to be His followers and sending them out on the limited commission, and later He'll send them out on the great commission. Not only when things were going well, but also when they disappointed Him, when they argued among themselves, when they did not grasp what He was trying to teach them. He loved them to the end. And I think there's comfort in that, because we disappoint ourselves sometimes. Others disappoint us in their Christian walk. And we may feel like, well, Jesus doesn't love me anymore after the way I've acted. Jesus doesn't love me anymore after the things that I've been responsible for. But did you know that there is nothing that any human being could do that would cause Jesus not to love them? Nothing. Now, I do not mean that He will save everybody, but He loves everybody and He desires that they be saved. Jesus loved His disciples to the end. Now, verse 2, and supper being ended, He's going to illustrate His love in a way they would never forget. The devil having now put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray Him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into His hands and that He was come from God and went to God, He riseth from supper and laid aside His garments, you know, like His, we would say His coat, His outer garments that would encumber Him, and took a towel and girded Himself. After that, He poureth water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel wherewith He was girded. One commentary that I was reading commented on this time of year. It was their rainy season. Of course, they didn't have paved roads, just dirt. And they wore sandals. And so when they were going from one place to another in the rainy season, the mud would sometimes go over their sandals, get between their toes. Their feet would be very dirty. And it was customary when you entered into someone's house for the host to provide water and a towel. And often, if it were a wealthy host, he would also provide a servant who would wash the feet of the guest. No one had washed any feet this time, and they're gathered around the table. You could almost see them, you know, sitting there with their feet dirty. And Jesus, what's He doing now? And He begins to wash the first one's feet. I don't know which one, maybe Bartholomew. You know, and the surprised look on His face when Jesus takes off His sandal, pours water on His foot. Can you picture it? He's going down the line. Now, this was a task not for a teacher, not for a rabbi, not for a master. Certainly not for a king. This was the lowest servant on the totem pole did this. You know, if you were the new guy in the household, this would be your job, washing someone's dirty feet. But Jesus is doing it. None of the disciples washed each other's feet, but Jesus, their master, is washing. Now, He gets to Peter. I don't know where Peter was in the line. Maybe he was, you know, the sixth halfway through or maybe toward the end. Anyway, Peter's been watching Jesus wash these other feet. And he's thinking, He's not going to do this to me. I'm not going to let Him wash my feet. And he gets to Peter and see what happens. Peter saith unto Him, verse 6, Lord, dost Thou wash my feet? What are you doing? Then cometh verse 7, Jesus answered and said, What I do Thou knowest not now. You don't really understand. Now, as we look back on it, we see, but in the moment, it would have been hard to recognize what a seminal moment this was in Christianity, how He was planting the seed that would really blossom into the tree of self-sacrifice and being willing to do whatever is needed for somebody else in their best interest. Peter couldn't grasp it at the moment, but later, when he matured, he'd be able to see it. And Jesus said, verse 7, What I do Thou knowest not, but Thou shalt know hereafter. And Peter said to Him, Thou shalt never wash my feet. I'm not going to let You do this. Jesus answered him, If I wash thee not, thou hast no part with Me. Pack up your bags and go back home. You're not one of My followers. Well, that hit Peter, as we might say, as like a ton of bricks. And in typical fashion for his personality, he responds very with overkill, and he says, Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head. If this means I'm Your follower, then don't just wash my feet. I want it from head to toe. I'm all in. And so Jesus washes His feet. And verse 11, for he knew who should betray him. Therefore, said he, you're not all clean. He knew about Judas. Can you picture him washing Judas's feet? What was going through his mind? I'm about to betray him, and here he is washing my feet. Verse 12, last part. Know you what I have done to you? Do you understand? He's trying to teach him the lesson that would never be forgotten because of the feet washing that went with it. You call me Master and Lord, and you say, well, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and Master, have washed your feet, ye also ought to wash one another's feet. You see, first the Bible says that he loved them, and then it shows that he loved them. And his love was not just in platitudes, but it was in dirty hands, in dirty towels, and embarrassing, awkward situations he was willing to put himself into because he loved them. For I have given you an example that you should do as I have done to you. Verily, verily, I say unto you, the servant is not greater than his Lord, neither he that is sent greater than he that sent him. If you know these things, happy are ye if you do them. It's one thing to talk about these kind of things in a Bible class, you know, being willing to do the menial task, the thing, to change the diapers or change the bandage on the wound that doesn't smell good, it doesn't look good, you know, to be able to do for someone else what they no longer can do for themselves. Well, all sounds good in this environment, but in a hospital room or in caring for someone who's bedfast at home or going to the scene of the accident, you know, there are a lot of places we may find ourselves. Well, yeah, I'm not going to do that. I mean, you know. Maybe, you know, where's the nurse? Or, you know, little brother or sister, she'll do it. She's always been kind-hearted. You see, Jesus showed us that he was not too good. Therefore, that's how Christianity shows its validity, is in actions and not only words. So that's our first lesson that you see about love in John 13, and it really starts off in a memorable way. But then as you move forward in this context, you see Jesus' emphasis on love in his teachings as well as his actions. He continues talking along the same lines. You drop down, for instance, in verse 23, the disciple whom Jesus loved. We'll reference that in our sermon later today. Just make a mental note of it here. And then Judas is dismissed in the next section. That gets you down to 31. Therefore, when he was gone out, Jesus said, now is the Son of Man glorified, and God is glorified in him. If God be glorified in him, God shall also glorify him in himself, and shall straightway glorify him. What he's talking about is that, you know, God loved his Son, and Jesus was about to go through this embarrassing, you think about the crucifixion. What are they going to do? Can you imagine someone coming up to you and arresting you? Putting your hands in front of your disciples and the community and taking you off to jail? Can you imagine being brought up on a court case and everybody in there and this is the one who's accused? Can you imagine hearing the judge condemn to death your name? Can you imagine having all your clothes stripped off publicly, with the exception of probably of a loincloth, and then at the whipping post, having that justice in their view administered, brought back in, mocked of the soldiers, crown of thorns, robe, bowing the knee, hitting him with a stick, slapping him, plucking his beard. Can you picture it? Can you picture him as the crucifixion unfolds and they put on his back, that same back that was just beaten, the crossbar? Carry this, having to carry your own execution material. So he's marched through the street, naked, people laughing at him. Again, probably a loincloth at the most. People poking fun, laughing, celebrating. He's marching probably a quarter of a mile. I don't know, but it was up a hill toward the end. So down the Kidron and up Golgotha. And then being crucified. Man, he knew all that was coming. But that didn't seem like the Lord was glorifying him at that point, did it? That was where he was being embarrassed, and that's part of the sacrifice he made for us. But then, up from the grave, he arose, and then he ascended to their Father's right hand, sat down, ruler over the earth. There's the glory that was coming. Now, why did he go through all that? It wasn't to receive the glory, because he already had the glory before he came to earth. Now, he gave all that up. He just got back what he had before. It was because of his love for us. Now, with that bigger picture in mind that was fast coming upon him, he's giving the disciples this one last sermon, this one last message. What would be the most important thing that he could tell them on the night before he dies? Well, would it be about the church? Would it be about the plan of salvation? What would it be about? Verse 33, "Little children, yet a little while I am with you." It was down now to only hours, you know, and then the post-resurrection appearances. "You shall seek me, as I said unto you, unto the Jews, whither I go, you cannot come. So now I say unto you, you won't be able to follow me. You're my followers, but you can't follow me into the grave. You can't follow me to heaven." Now watch 34. "A new commandment I give unto you, that you love one another." Now that wasn't a new commandment. Leviticus 19:18 said that, love your neighbor as yourself. So that was even a part of the old law. So why is he claiming this to be a new commandment? It's not new in its root, but it's new in its expression. It's new to its degree, because he modifies it, that you love one another as I have loved you. That's what's new about it. The world had never seen love like this before. Love where a teacher will wash dirty feet. Love where a God will come to earth and be stripped, beaten, hated, and killed for humanity who did not even love Him. Well, that's a new kind of love. Well, that's how much I want you to love. I don't want you to love your neighbor like you love yourself. That'd be improvement for most of us right there. But even beyond that, love your neighbor as I have loved you. That's the ultimate degree of love. Because Jesus never held anything back. "By this shall all men know that you are my disciples, if you have love one to another." I hope that our community knows a lot of things about us as a church. But I hope the one thing that they talk about the most is that church loves each other. That church, they're unbelievable what they'll do for each other. Well, that's what Jesus wants for His church. Well, let's continue reading here. I want to hit the highlights of the love that you find here. Go over to chapter 14 now, and let's pick up again. Their hearts are troubled, as you might imagine. You know, it's dawning on them, something's about to happen. You know, all these things He's been telling us about for the last 6 months or so, beginning with Peter's confession in Matthew 16 and following. When he had taken them on that, what we would call a retreat, for the first time revealed to them that he was going to die. No, Peter said, no, be this far from me. He rebuked him. And Jesus said, get thee behind me, Satan. You know, well, I came here to do this, I'm going to do it. It was dawning on them slowly that this is really going to happen. So their hearts are troubled, verse 1, let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. So our faith gets us through our troubling times. But in this context of Him trying to comfort them, He tells them how to respond to what He's doing for them. And that's in verse 14. If you shall ask anything, verse 14, in my name, I will do it. Now 15, if ye love me, tonight we'll talk about that, the response of love. If ye love me, keep my commandments. Well, that's a short verse. You could memorize it just by reading it about three times. Many of us already could say it without looking. Oh, but living it, that's a challenging one. Jesus said, if you love me, show me. Prove it. How? Well, not by how many prayers we pray, or how many classes we attend, or how many chapters we read. All those things are good and necessary, important. But show me how much you love me by how you obey me. In the same context, drop down to 21. He that hath my commandments and keepeth them. You know, we have our Bibles. They're in our possession. We read them. We check it off of the chart. We bring them to church services and we follow along with whatever the preacher or teacher is saying. We have the commandments. But it's more than that. And keepeth them. He it is that loveth me. How do I know if I love the Lord? Just need to look at my record of following Him. And he that loveth me shall be loved of my Father, and I will love him and will manifest myself to him. So the more obedient we are, the closer we can be to the Lord, and the more things we learn about Him. It's like a lot of other things. You know, one door will open. When you go through one door, then another door will open. But if you never go through the first door, you won't ever even know there is another door. And it's that way in Christianity. The lower we go and the more loving we become, the more new truths open to us that were there all along, but we would not see them until we were in a new perspective to appreciate them. You continue reading in this, drop down to 23. Jesus answered and said unto them, if a man love me, he will keep my words, and my Father will love him, and we will come unto him and make our abode with him. 24, he that loveth me not keepeth not my sayings. And the word which ye hear is not mine, but the Father's which sent me. I think sometimes in a modern religion, there's a dichotomy, at least in teaching and practice. There almost seems like a liberal attitude toward the Bible. You know, we don't really worry about doctrine much in this church, but we're really big on love. And we're a friendly church. And then here's another congregation. Well, we're really strict on doctrine, but you get the feeling it's a refrigerator in there when you go in. It's not very warm and it's not very loving. You know, neither one of those is what the Lord expects of this church, of His church. We need to have a very great respect for the words of God, to be strict on doctrine, if you want to say it that way, but not to the exclusion of being a loving people. Because this text says those two things go together and you can't have one without the other. He said, if you love me, keep my commandments. So we have to know and obey, but that should prompt in those who are obeying to find these commandments that have to do with not just vertical response, that is our response to God, but horizontal response. Our lives with each other, in our immediate families, with our spouses, with our children, with our grandchildren, then in our larger circle of friends and daily acquaintances, those we work with and neighbors too, and then in the larger circle still as we reach out to the people that we don't even know, but when we have an opportunity, an occasion to show love to them, then we do not hesitate to do it. And then when you bring it home to the church, the love that we have for each other, you know, those are all horizontal relationships. That's what Jesus is saying here. You know, don't try to make a false wall between, you know, being a loving church or being a doctrinal church. Be both, because that's the only way that God will accept it. Because a church that respects Jesus will act as Jesus did, and that was always with love. You also see in this same context, let's drop down to 15. This begins with the famous teaching, I'm the vine, you're the branches. You know, you can't separate yourself from me or you won't have any nourishment. You'll die. A branch has to be connected to the root system. And so the Christians are the branches. We're all connected to the Lord, and He's the one that gives us our strength. He keeps us vibrant and vital. Well, in that context, it doesn't take Him long to get circled back to His same theme of love. You drop down to verse 9, and the Father, as the Father hath loved me. Well, how much would you say the Father loved Jesus? There would not be words to describe that, would there? And there's the most loving relationship that is possible to imagine. God the Father loving Jesus. And Jesus says in the next phrase, so, a little word with a big meaning. It means to be equal to. So have I loved you. Jesus said, I love these disciples as much as my Father in heaven loves me. Now that's quite a tremendous statement. Continue ye in my love. Same context. He talks about obedience again in 10. If you keep my commandments, you see how he connects it repeatedly. He wants their joy to be full in verse 11, the latter part. And now 12, this is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. I have a note here, and I don't know if I got this from, could it be from one of Brandon's lessons or Chance's, but I made a note beside the word commandment that love is not optional nor emotional, but it is a command of God. Now, you can't command somebody to have an emotion because that's beyond their ability to do. I can't command you to be happy or to be sad or to be mad. Those are responses that are not of the will. Well, when Jesus commands us to love, He's not commanding us warm fuzzies. You know, it's that usually follows our actions, our love. But the command here is agape love, not some phileo love, some friend love. It's the kind of love, not that has to do with the emotions, but it has to do with the actions. And so he's saying, I command you to love. What does that mean? It means that I will do for the other person what Jesus would do for that person. It's a decision that I make. And then, of course we have friendship love, in the church. We enjoy seeing each other. I like to hear the buzz in the room in the foyer when everybody's coming in, and the genuine joy that you just see on the faces of people who haven't seen each other usually in a few days, and they're catching. There is that in a good church where you have people you love to be around, you enjoy talk. But that's not what he's saying here. He's not commanding that. What he's commanding is that we're going to be there for each other. We're going to do what needs to be done. We're going to go the second mile. And whatever it is that I know of that I can fix, I'm going to be there to do to fix. So it's a command and not just an emotional response. Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. When Jesus is staring that shadow. He's standing in the shadow of that cross, thinking about what he's about to do. They might not have understood it exactly at that moment. But he said, I'm about to demonstrate the greatest love that you'll ever see. And that's going to be when I'm hurting, bleeding, having difficulty breathing, dying on the tree. That is the world's greatest manifestation of love ever seen, ever to be seen. Ye are my friends if you do whatsoever I command you. 14. So he keeps going back to that same thought of his love, divine love for man, and then man's response to that love. And he's in this last night, I'm not going to be with you every day. I'm not going to be able to tell you these things anymore. But tonight, I want to remind you, I really want to impress you with this one thing. Love. Don't forget love. That's going to be your motivation for your relationship with me. And it's going to be the glue that ties you together as a people. Now, you continue in the same context. You drop down, you see the contrast with love in 17, or 18 rather. If the world hate you, you know that it hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love his own. But because you're not of the world, but I have chosen you out of the world, therefore the world hateth you. It's disappointing that the world does not reward love, true love, but it won't. If Jesus could live among men for 33 years and interact on a daily basis from city to city, community to community, village to village, person to person for 3 years, and them see divine love in word, in deed, in life, and then say, let's kill him. He doesn't deserve to live here anymore. I mean, if that could happen to Jesus, how could we expect that we would walk through a world in a lifetime and everybody's always going to love us and treat us right? No, if we stand for what's right. And he goes into this a lot in John. In John chapter 3, he talks about lovers of darkness, and because of sin, people will reject righteousness and light. They want to stay in the dark, and a good example is a rebuke to them, and so they hate it. So you see that repeated over and over in every generation. And that's what Jesus is saying here. I'm going to warn you ahead of time. I want you to love me. I want you to love everybody. But do not expect everybody to love you back. But some people are going to respond in the opposite. And you may have had that experience. You know, you really help somebody. What is it? No good deed goes unpunished. You know, the old saying. You try to help somebody and then lo and behold, you turn around and you feel betrayed or backstabbed because they didn't respond with the same kind of love that you had shown to them maybe over a long period of time. Or you try to help somebody come out of sin and be saved. You talk to them and you show them in the Scriptures and they don't want to speak to you anymore. They just ignore you. You know, you lose a friendship. Well, that hurts us, but it doesn't surprise us because Jesus said, that happened to me first. And if it happened to me, it will happen to you. Remember verse 20, the word that I said unto you, the servant is not greater than his Lord. If they have persecuted me, they will also persecute you. If they have kept my saying, they will keep yours also. It's an interesting statement. You think about how great a preacher Jesus was. But Jesus said, you know, I had success and failure in preaching, and that's the same thing's going to happen to you. And it really doesn't matter who the speaker is, even if it's Jesus, he's saying, they're either going to accept it or reject it. It doesn't have a lot to do with who the mouthpiece for truth is. All right, I want to drop down to chapter 16 now. There's a lot more in that chapter. Let's go to 16 and see this thread of love being woven through these five chapters. Let's go toward the end of the chapter. Jesus is again emphasizing that he wants their joy to be full in 24. And he's had to speak in Proverbs to them, especially in public, often in 25. But the last part of that says, but I shall show you plainly of the Father. You know, I haven't always been able to express myself completely, but that full revelation is coming. The Holy Spirit's going to come upon you and guide you into all truth. The last verse 26 of the previous chapter emphasizes it again in verse 13 of this chapter. So I'm not going to leave you alone. It's necessary for me to leave because the Spirit won't come until I leave. And when the Spirit comes, then He's going to bring to your remembrance everything that I've taught you and reveal new things to you that I did not teach you, did not have time. And so there's that comfort. That gets us down to 26. And that day ye shall ask in my name, I say not unto you that I will pray the Father for you, for the Father Himself loveth you. You think about what the privilege of prayer is. Now we pray in Jesus' name or by His authority, but we get to come boldly before the throne of God. Hebrews 4:16. We don't have to say, Jesus, would you take this? We can go. Now He's our mediator. He's our intercessor. The Father Himself loveth you because you have loved me and have believed that I came out from God. I come forth from the Father and am come into the world. Again, I leave the world and go to the Father. So you see that pre-existence, incarnation, death, resurrection, ascension in one verse. What a remarkable verse. And then the disciples were pleased. Lo, now speakest thou plainly and speakest no proverb. Now we are sure and know that thou knowest all things, and needest not that any man should ask thee. By this we believe that thou camest forth from God. I like to look at Jesus through the eyes of the disciples, because they really are every man's eyes. I mean, we didn't get to see Jesus with our own eyes. We didn't get to hear Him with our ears. We didn't get to observe His character and ponder it personally as they did. So really, these 12 apostles are the eyes of the world looking at Jesus. But they're ordinary men. I mean, they're fishermen and tax collectors. You know, they're regular people. We would have related well to them with whatever our occupations are. And so whatever they saw him in him would be what we would have seen in him. And so I love these kind of statements. When now we are sure, that implies that they weren't gullible or easily persuaded. You know, the first time Jesus said, "I'm the Son of God," they may not have believed it. Or they may have had a little doubt. Or they may have come and gone. But here they say, now we're sure. You know, they had been collecting this evidence, the evidence of His words, of His deeds, and now of His love. Now we know. We've got enough evidence to make an informed decision. That informed decision is that you came from God. You are the Son of God. Jesus said, "Do you now believe? Behold, the hour cometh, yea, is now come, that ye shall be scattered, everyone to his own, and shall leave me alone. And yet I am not alone, because the Father is with me." Remember, He's in the shadow of the cross. He knows He's about to be arrested in chapter 18. And they're all going to flee for their lives, even though they make bold statements, especially Peter. "I won't do it," but he did. But Jesus is not going to give up on them. Then He loves them to the end. He knows that just as chicks scatter, they come back to the mother, the hen. "These things I have spoken to you, that in me ye might have peace. In the world ye shall have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world." Now that brings us down, and I won't be able to discuss this as much as I'd like, but I'll just mention this to you. Jesus' last prayer, and in His prayer you see His love expressed at the very end. Notice verse 26. "And I have declared unto them thy name, and will declare it, that the love wherewith thou hast loved me may be in them, and I in them." You see, that thread comes to the knot in the last verse, the next verse, first verse of the next chapter. They cross the Kidron and go into the garden where He's arrested. So there you have that memorable occasion, the last night of Jesus with His disciples, and love was what was on His mind. I'm grateful for your attention this morning. We'll be dismissed until the worship hour.